Good morning. It's 9:01 a.m. on January 1, 2013. Happy New Year. It's got to be better than last year. I mean, truly, it's going to be a lot worse in many regards, but personally, I've done a lot of suffering, and I'm going to change my attitude and treat it all as a big burden that I'll eat away at until it's all gone this year. So 2013 is going to be okay. Anyway, this is a Wujo on the little bloop theory, chakras and mudras. But it's also a test of our ability to host on our new servers the Wujos as well as the other audios and work out some glitches. So we're doing this today just to test everything, but also to wrap up the talk on the chakras and then fill in some gaps on the little bloop theory as it relates to space, gravity, and time. We'll finish the chakra business here first. I've only gone as high as the throat chakra, so I can't speak of impersonal knowledge of the third eye chakra or the crown chakra. That's the thousand petal lotus that opens up. A couple of things to note about them. The chakra is from the Muladhara, which goes at the base of the spine at the sacrum and tilts slightly on the outside of the body, and actually is what connects you to the yin energy of the earth. It's really interesting. I mean, when you look at the humans from the perspective of the chakras, we are creatures that have these tendrils that basically come out of our tailbone area, the sacrum, that triangular shaped bone with all those nice little holes that has these interesting dimensions. Should anybody ever want to get into sacred geometry, check out the dimensions of the sacrum. But in any event, from that perspective, we have these tendrils that go out from there, reach down to the ground. If you eliminate our skin body and all of our flesh body and just dealt with this as our energy body and the chakras, then you would see that that is our support to the ground. And we have a similar plate. The chakras are like giant petals. Let's stop for a second. Describe them real quick. They're like giant petals. They spin flowers, and they're composed of multiple petals. The Muladhara has four. It spins slowly. It's in my experience, and I'm speaking from personal experience, that as you rise up through the chakras, they spin faster as you go higher. And there are more petals in each of the arrangements of the chakra as you progress upward. And you go through the Muladhara all the way up through to the crown chakra, and there's seven of them. These correspond to the three Dandian of the Taoist, the Chinese understanding. This the chakras are basically a Hindu understanding or a yogic understanding, because yoga spans the Hindu religion and is larger than that. So anyway, these chakras have various different arrangements of numbers of petals in them, and there's a slight concavity at the center of them. That actually, by the way, the concavity is where you go in your meditative state to cross into the stream. Do not do this unless you know what the hell you're doing. It's very scary, and you can find yourself lost. If you don't know how to leave a trail of crumbs to get back, there's all different kinds of, let's use a word that doesn't really apply, let's call it material fluff that can cause you issues. There's also other beings on the stream, because bear in mind, you're going through your own chakra at that point, through the null point, the zero point that does not spin, and you're entering into the other side, and it's very much like the time tunnel kind of things they show you on TV, where you zip through. Now, with one exception, all of the chakras have more petals as you climb up, and they spin faster. And I'm up at the fifth chakra, which is the throat chakra, and it tilts slightly. Oh, let me stop for a second and go back to the third chakra, the Manipura. That's the one that's in your solar plexus. And it's where the Muladhara is tilted downward slightly and has tendrils that going out into the earth. The Manipura is like basically horizontal to your spine. It's parallel to your spine. It sticks out somewhat from your body ever so slightly. It's more or less around what is known as the Hara, which is an inch or so below your navel. Two fingers usually, the knuckles of your first two fingers usually defines that. this chakra sits out flat relative to you, and it has tendrils that can reach out and go out. And these tendrils, they go out into the things of the earth, other beings, if you will. And so from that perspective, we have tendrils that then go out, tendrils of energy. They're not physical or pseudopodia or anything. They're energetic tendrils that go on out and connect us to all of reality. And so from that viewpoint, with our body removed, the tubular body, the skin body, the muscle body, the bone body, and we're left with the energy body and the fluid body, we see this interchange in the fluids of the body with the energy, and that's how the energy comes from the chakra system into the fluids first, because it's less dense, actually into the gases that are dissolved in the fluids, because those are the least dense, then into the fluids, then into the more dense as you go on. This is why it takes longer to recycle the bone material in your body than it does, say, your brain material or your skin material, these kind of things. And these are all recycled continuously, which we can get to in a minute when we actually talk about the little bloop. So the chakra, the Manipura chakra that's just out there, is very much akin to the description that was given by that Indian shaman, Don Juan. One of these guys. Anyway, in Carlos Castaneda's books, is Don Juan. And he was a skilled Manipura tendril user and could theoretically hold himself up with these energy tendrils, which he could control at will. And I've read of examples, and I've known one guy who had some skill with it. He wasn't really skilled. He couldn't hold himself up, but he could move things with these tendrils out from his body. So if there was like a chair or something in front of him, he could come along, and without physically touching it, it was a couple of inches away. As long as he was aligned with the Manipura tendrils, he could like sort of bunch them up or something, I don't know the mechanism, and cause the chair to bump out of the way slightly. It was an interesting effect. Obviously, he's much more skilled now if he's still been pursuing it. This was a number of years back. But so these kind of things do indeed present themselves from the chakras, but that's not what they're there for. The chakras spin. And as I was saying, with one exception, Ajna, the flame chakra, the sixth chakra at the pineal gland that I'm facing now, with that one exception, they all gain petals as you climb upwards within the system. And they also gain speed as they as you go up. So if you can see your chakras spin, usually it starts out, I guess, with a Muladhara, and so it's this slow spin that you just get real used to. Then as you climb on up, you see that the rate of spin can change. And it depends on whichever chakra you put your consciousness in as to the rate of spin you're experiencing at that particular point. And also, each one of these present perhaps a different level. I haven't investigated that because I've been busy as a toad on a hot plate here this whole last year. But they may present different avenues, if you will, into the non-material part of reality, the other side of materium. In other words, the stream may be different depending on which chakra you go through. But the Ajna chakra, the one I'm facing now at the third eye, that only has two petals. Why this should be, I don't know. Its issues with spin are different. Its shape is different. It presents many different characteristics than any of the others that I've climbed up through. And at some point, I'll broach this and be able to determine a little bit more. I'm starting to use some of the techniques that I'll discuss in a half a second to examine some of these differences, between the Ajna and the next one down, which is the Vishuddhi. That's the throat chakra, which is at an interesting angle. That was unexpected. It's actually at an angle referring relative to the backside of your jaw, which is was unexpected. I fell into it from one, jumped up from the one below the heart chakra and into the throat chakra, and it's like, wow, hey, this is interesting. This is an odd little angle to get into, and I haven't really examined that much yet. But anyway, so the chakras are all the way up to the crown chakras, with that one exception. They gain petals, and after you get through the Ajna and you get to the crown or the Brahma or Sahasrara chakra, the Brahman chakra, that's the thousand petal lotus, because it's got so many petals and it spins so fast. Apparently it's an amazing experience when you get there. But they're all opalescent or pearlescent when you are, quote, visualizing them, when you're in them. And it's very much a visual experience. I'm not being facetious at that at all. There's no illusion about this visual experience. It is every bit as visual and as tactile in that sense with your eyes, sensing, touching with your eyes, as any visual experience you're going to have in the materium. And it's quite an oddity in that regard. So you can tell, for instance, when someone's actually experienced this, because their language about it is just so plain, and it's always usually tinged with a bit of wonder and awe, because it's really freaky. You just don't know what's going on when you first have it happen. And then to live with it for a number of years and explore it is an interesting process. So anyway, I'm stuck pushing this ajna chakra, and so I started investigating some of the techniques that I can use to get up to it, that's why I've been following and getting involved with the mudras. There's some mudras that you can use with your tongue. Now, I had not brought this up before. A lot of people, when I discuss my meditation techniques and wujo some time back, said, oh, well, you left one out, which is the tongue at the intersection of the soft and the hard palate at the roof of the mouth. And no, I did not leave it out. I just didn't want to discuss it because it's a real dangerous one unless you're really prepared to live with the consequences, because that's not really it. There's a threefold component to that, that mudra, and its position, and then its pressure, and then its direction. And so that mudra is quite specific, and it's threefold, and it's bifurcated. There's two halves to that. So there's actually the three components doubled. And it's very difficult to live with the results of it if you're unprepared. If you don't have your Muladhara chakra moving, you shouldn't be messing with that mudra. And I'm not going to go into the details of it. You can look it up and experiment for yourself if you want, if you really want to get into the danger of it all, because of the things that that particular mudra does relative to your pineal gland through the parathyroid system and the parasympathetic, or what we know as the autonomic nervous system. So you got to be real careful with it, because you can really screw yourself up. We have to note something here, that meditation is not without its risks. Let me just put it this way. Meditation in general is reasonably safe, but the path to enlightenment is not without its risks. And if you read some of the literature in the original Chinese, which frequently is mistranslated in modern-day English, why that should be, I don't know. Probably the subject of its own wujo. But if you read some of the original Chinese of the 5th century Taoists, who were, it's really, I would think, admittedly, by most of the people that study them, that was the peak of the intellectual thought. Anyway, the 5th century, there they discussed the 10,000 martyrs. And it was not or the 10,000 lost. You'll see it referenced many different ways. But usually it's 10,000, and it's actually more than that, but that number was just chosen to represent 10,000 people that have gone before and died in the process of searching for these various techniques that are passed down. And thus we find the need for the guru, disciple, or mentor, student path, because usually the mentor is standing there before you, and or guru, and if they know what the hell they're doing, A, they've done it themselves and they've survived, so they've probably got a few clues. Whereas, just reading about it, this is why it's often said that you shouldn't proceed on these paths, just reading the words of dead people, because their words don't usually come with the cautions relative or specific to your situation. And it is dangerous. I know this to be true. So exploring these things is not without its risk. Go there knowing that as an adult, knowing that you can screw yourself up for, and here's the thing, guys, you can screw yourself up beyond this life, in the sense that if you don't know what you're doing and you proceed incautiously, some of the risks can carry over to multiple lifetimes. So the penalties are much heavier than merely death. That's just the gateway to the penalty, if you understand what I'm saying. And this was quite clearly expressed in a lot of the writings of the 5th century Taoists, some of which I've had the privilege to read with a very knowledgeable Chinese fellow at my side. So we got a really good understanding of what was being said. and what was being involved. So be careful with these mudras. Now this brings up, so actually let me explain that there are mudras with the hands, there's mudras with the feet, there's mudras with the body, there's mudras with the tongue. There are mudras with the eyes, although they're limited, and their effectiveness is only rarely demonstrated in this plane, I think, in the last few centuries. The materium, I mean. It takes a very special person to be able to get into that. But the mudras with the hands are very interesting. And I think people should be aware that the dark mudras exist. The dark mudras are hand gestures, specific forms, that your mind will translate through the reading process to a word that can actually trigger itself as a command if you've been linguistically programmed. In the sense that if you've got a pre-hypnotized suggestion in your brain from watching Fox News too much, then somebody could use a mudra, catch on to that particular whirling bit of neurons in your brain and command you to go there, and you would never even know it because they wouldn't express the command verbally. They would do it in the form of a mudra, a hand gesture, a series of them actually, linked up, done in a specific way. They can also use shadow, by the way, light and shadow, be careful of that, to actually form the same symbols. And your mind will take these in through the visual cortex and through the eyes. They'll reverse them from right to left, top to bottom, and present them as a grapheme in the visual cortex of the brain, way in the back of the brain. And a lot of your brain energy is then trapped up in decoding these, and it gets energized, but it also sucks energy away from conscious thought and can be a distractant. As well as a command, so be aware of that. And the grapheme, once it's established in your brain, then actually, because of the nature of the grapheme, it's not just a random image, it's actually a letter or a word or a command, and is read that way by your brain, then the grapheme will flop over and become a phoneme within the linguistic center of your brain, which is usually located below the left eye and slightly back of the sinus cavities in that area. Parallel with the left eye and behind the sinus cavities. So here you have a situation where people do hand gestures. Your brain is reading it as though you were reading a giant placard that says, you know, become hypnotized, go to sleep, let me steal your watch. Yeah, there are people that use it at that level. And you'll respond that way. You'll become hypnotized, you'll go to sleep, you won't see anything, they'll let you, and you'll let them steal your watch, and you'll be quite happy. And because of the way that it was all done, you'll just maybe even be totally unaware of it until several hours later. You'll think your watch has been misplaced, or then you'll realize it's stolen, and yet you're literally hours away from the scene at which it occurred. So these mudras exist. There's ways to guard yourself against them. I'm seeing more and more indicators that they're using them in TV. I don't watch TV, but you can actually see some of it in the shadow play that comes out in a television reflected into a mirror that is seen through a sheet of paper. And it's an experiment. It's an interesting experimental way to catch subliminals, because the sharp subliminal lines of the word is they're usually using a yellow or a whitish font on a black background, or the reverse, light background, dark font, but in either case the sharp edges show up through the paper, and you don't really, and the paper has a tendency, if it's the right kind of waxed paper, has a tendency to fog all the other images, so your eye doesn't even really see the people involved or whatever. You just all of a sudden see these flashes of the subliminals coming out. As I say, it's an interesting technique, but don't spend days staring at it to catch it, because you have to train your eyes to do it. And I use Vortex, my reading software, so I've trained my eyes to catch very rapid flickers. Because basically that's what it does. So anyway, back to the mudras. You got people using these dark mudras against us, and it just may be of interest to educate yourself about them. And you're now going to start seeing, I think the next thing is they'll start using colors, the color mudras against you. There are certain colors that can be used to actually cause you to be basically self-hypnotizing. They don't work ubiquitously. The color thing is not as powerful as the mudras, because the mudras are more or less common language with a human brain, whereas the colors are very specific to the body type. So some people would be affected by a particular kind of a blue and others wouldn't. They would need to have a green or an orange or something. So they can't use it in a broadcast manner as effectively as they can the mudras. I think that'll be their next stage as they start clamping down on fought here. They're going to really ratchet up on all these tricky little bits. So last thing here in our test, I know we're about 20 minutes now, and I didn't want to take up too much of the time, is that I want to talk about Stargate, which is part of my little bloop theory. The Stargate is just there as a reminder of STG, because excuse me, the little bloop theory is the antithesis to the Big Bang. The Big Bang, it comes to the idea that there was this little P-shaped thing that exploded and all of space existed, and then there was a few bits of atoms around, and we've been filling up this big empty envelope of space ever since it happened 12 or 13 billion years ago. And that's bullshit. Doesn't happen that way. Never did. One of the premises of active, effective science is that whatever you postulate can't be the God in the machine. It can't be a one-time event. It can't be a miracle. It's got to exist now. It's got to have been part of existence at all times and can't have ceased as a process. So if you're going to tell me that, you know, hydrogen grows legs and walks and talks and spits in public and is a problem, the hydrogen molecule, then, well, it better be happening right now if that's your premise. You can't say it happened once and never since. So this is basically one of the premises against the idea of external saviors and the idea of the Messiah. It's a bunch of bullshit. In any event, so the little bloop theory is that there's 22 trillion times a second, there's this pulse that comes on. The little bloop theory starts out this way. Instead of the Big Bang, there was a single atom that formed. So we agree on that. There was this little tiny thing that occurred. And in my case, I'm saying it was a negative form, a negative ionized form of hydrogen that occurred first. And this actually occurred about, my way of calculating, about 3 to 6 seconds into the creation of the materium. And from then on, it's been continuous, and I'll explain in a second how rapidly it's occurring and so on. But here's the deal. The materium is formed by this pulse of energy that goes beyond time and space and travels instantly from the middle of universe to every single thing, all the galaxies in the universe, to the center of them, then to all of the solar systems, then to all of the stars in the solar systems, all the planets, all the dust, all the people, all the dogs, all the cats, all the frogs, toads, lizards, and everything else. Plants, etc. And this pulse is, let's just say it's the yin energy. And this yin energy pulse travels instantaneously and it creates universe. In our minds, because our minds don't work very fast, we see it as solid. But really it's a series of flashes, like one might think of as a strobe light only. And you know that weird effect if you've ever seen it. But it's like a strobe light going 22 trillion times a second, so there is no weird effect. You actually think it's solid, because anytime you reach out with your hand, which is actually made out of energy, and has a feedback loop made out of energy, it touches something that it thinks is solid, but it's actually made out of energy, but it's energy touching energy, and it feeds back to you, and you think it's solid because of this. And also because they've lied to you, that is to say the education system, that says that atoms are this persistent thing that hang around forever. Not the case. So in my understanding of how the materium came about, and the materium is the place where matter exists, this is where our brains are currently operating, and my tongue's flapping in my teeth to create airwaves that you guys are going to, the machinery is going to interpret into a digital signal processor, going to present it to you in a form that your ears are going to think is actual sound. All of this is an illusion. It's all energy. And so many levels that we can't even really discuss it effectively, because it would take all day. But let's talk about the energy that creates it all. That's this 22 trillion times a second pulse. There's also this 22 trillion times a second pause in which the energy sags or disappears for that 22 trillionth of a second. And thus, when it recreates itself, things can move because they don't jam into themselves, so to speak, and we don't leave a trail of ourself behind, because it is that we live in a universe of continuous creation and destruction. We did not have an initial creation of the universe. There is no creator of the universe as they would have you understand it. There was no being that sat out there and spat the universe out that way. The materium exists within the materium is the universe and all the other universes, and this is created through this pulse that happens continuously creating the materium and continuously destroying it so things can move, atoms and everything else. It obviously has to create itself and destroy itself faster than our ability to measure the fastest thing in terms of the universe. In other words, if we're going to have an atom that we say has an electron that spins around at, you know, a billion times a second, well, then we'd better have our flashy creation of universe faster than a billion times a second. And we arrive at, I arrived at the notion that it was 22 trillion times a second, because that's basically three and a smudge times greater plus one, or times one magnitude over Avogadro's number, based on the relative volume for, and a certain temperature and pressure for negatively ionized hydrogen, which I did a few years back when I didn't have much else to do and I'd had a saw go through my leg, so I was kind of confined for a couple of days. Anyway, so the little bloop theory is that these 22 trillion times a second lines, this pulse of energy bounced off itself and created itself. Now, in the very first part of universe consisted, the materium consisted only of that single atom. And it never blew up. It never created a giant space or anything like that. It doesn't work that way. That little atom, hydrogen ion, created itself, and it brought with it the space that it needed to exist in. It also brought with it the gravity it needs and the time that it needs to exist. These are part of the attributes of material reality that come along when it creates itself. So time is not independent of the creation of this particular hydrogen atom, nor is gravity, nor is the space. They are all concurrently created when the atom creates itself and pops into the materium. And it pops into the materium. The very first one popped into the materium when, in my estimation, when the 22 trillion times the second lines had crashed into themselves for about 3 to 6 seconds. That would have given, I think, sufficient mass, if you will, energetically, to have caused that first Anu, the first indivisible unit, as the Buddhists call it, to begin to work its way through from the energy realm into the material realm. And on this side, that thing is an atom, which I think was a negatively ionized hydrogen atom. So that's how it happened. The very first atom created itself, and it goes bloop, and it pops into the universe, and that's all there is this one little atom. But because of the nature of that pulse that was behind it and creating it and destroying it continuously, because as soon as it creates itself, it's destroying itself and creating itself in the materium 22 trillion times a second. But as the instant that that happened, it was also joined by another atom going bloop. And then, so there were two atoms in universe. And then there were, the instant that that happened, there were three and four and so on. Because the difference, in my estimation, between the very first atom creating itself in the third to sixth second and the size of the universe 1 second later is massively huge. But it has nothing to do with a Big Bang. Just that there were so many bazillions of atoms creating themselves so simultaneously that all of materium just started growing, and it's been growing ever since. And we have evidence of that, the way that the dark matter, so to speak, is pushing, those are the Anu, the indivisible units, are pushing everything aside, and the universe is theoretically expanding. Now, the Big Bang would say that we're expanding inside to the infinite limit of the infinite envelope that existed, and that's where all the space is. The little bloop theory says, bullshit, it's still infinite, and it can expand infinitely, and there's no need to even envision an envelope, because each atom brings with it its own envelope of the appropriate size. Thus, we have the ability to have a uranium atom pop in with 235 chunks of material pretending to exist at its nucleus versus the hydrogen atom with one chunk of material pretending to exist. And yet they would require a different space when they come in, and of course they bring different space when they come in. They also bring in different gravity and different time. And this was the point of this particular discussion, was to bring up those two elements as regards to the little bloop theory, and to let you know how they work. So it can be easily seen that space will grow orderly, infinitely, each time a new atom creates itself. When an atom disappears, it takes the space that it occupied out. But atoms have a longer lifespan relative to the history of new atoms being created than they do destructive history. Therefore, the universe grows as opposed to apparently shrinking. But you could also easily imagine that if the process decided to reverse itself, it would just start sucking up the atoms in the reverse of that little bloop, and you would get this effect of the universe decreasing. And it could be orderly as well. Needn't be violent in any regard. And so the Anu, the indivisible unit, are out there creating themselves and popping into existence as they are required to, based on the templates that are out there within that pulse. And that's a whole other discussion, is the templates component. But in any event, when the atoms come on in, they not only bring the space they need, they bring in the gravity they need. This makes sense because, therefore, if the hydrogen atom knows how heavy it needs to be, and the uranium atom knows how heavy it needs to be, so they bring those along with them. According to the ancient Sanskrit understanding, the yogic understanding, each and every one of these Anu, each and every one of the indivisible units, has the capacity to bring in up to 66,000 attributes with it, including things like gravity and time. Now, all of them bring in gravity and time, or in the main they do. We've got machinery, the Large Hadron Collider, that are trying to create the, or force the Anu to create themselves without certain aspects of their, and attributes they would normally bring along. This is a dangerous practice in my mind. However, not the discussion for today. The Anu, the indivisible unit, the Kalapa, as Buddhists call them, bring not only their space and their gravity, but they also bring their time. Now, gravity and time are equal attributes on the other side of the materium, and they are unequal, opposite parts of duality on this side of the materium. And here's how they are equal and opposite on this side of the materium. Gravity is thought of as the weak force by physicists, and the reason that they think that has to do with how they've smashed atoms and all of this kind of stuff. But in reality, it can be easily understood that gravity is a weaker force than time because of the way that gravity works. Gravity only knows how to react with other gravity close to it. And it knows how to react to those other gravities in different ways. It's very sophisticated. It's very intelligent in that regard, because the gravity of your individual atoms know that your atoms belong to you, so that when you get up, you don't leave parts of your butt in that chair. Nor do you suck up parts of that chair and walk around with it clinging to your ass. You don't ever meld your clothes into your body, usually, or any of this kind of stuff. And that's because the atoms of your body and the atoms of the other things within the materium all have gravity that is intelligent enough to know its place, so to speak. And we can talk about that intelligence in another Wujo, because it's rather interesting, and it's a component of the templates. Now, the smart gravity, if you will, it only interacts locally. So the gravity of your body, it's true, it actually does make a difference to the star Sirius, okay? Way the hell gone from here. Or even to our own sun. The gravity of your walking around changes the planet. And the gravity of your farts changes the atmosphere. But I would dare say that the level of impact is far, far greater with a fart pollution of the atmosphere from the gravity component than our effect on the sun. So our effect on the sun, gravity-wise, is very, very, very weak, because gravity is only strong when interacting through the template closest to it, and it has a very weak force far away. So gravity, to a certain extent, can be nullified relatively easily, because you can generate stronger forces that will impel the gravity or disrupt the ability of the smart gravity to understand what's close to it, and then it'll just sort of behave isolated in on its own and not try and do anything with the other gravity around it. Thus is basically the principle of anti-gravity. If you shield the object with a high enough level of radiation, a higher level of vibration than is being expressed by the gravity at that point, then the gravity is neutralized. And yet the gravity within the object doesn't come apart. When you get into an anti-gravity machine, for instance, your cells don't fly apart if they design the machine appropriately. If they don't, they could. Your cells could fly apart if the gravity on the inside of the machine was disrupted and in an inappropriate way. All of the cells would decide, well, I don't belong with this other cell, and they'd go decide that the next time they created themselves and the next pulse, they wouldn't be together. And then the next time after that, they'd be further apart, and so on and so on. And that's basically how gravity works. And you can see that gravity at a weak level in space, where you get two objects and there really isn't anything between them, the gravities are going to seek out each other and extend themselves out into a much further area, because they're not involved with a lot of atoms around them. And so the gravity will have, if you will, more spare time to seek out gravity that's further away. So gravity actually works differently in space when there's less crap around than it does down here on planets. And this actually has to do with the way in which the yin energy, which is a collective template override on gravity functions. So gravity is like that. It's a weak force, but it's very strong close to itself, and very weak as it gets away. Now, time also comes in with the atoms as they create themselves. So, for instance, the negatively ionized hydrogen atom will bring in some time for its lifespan, and as will the uranium atom. And we know from reality that hydrogen won't last as long as uranium. For various different reasons, the hydrogen ion will go all scurrying about and destroy itself in some kind of a chemical reaction or electrical energetic reaction, actually, in a much more rapid nature than will the uranium atom. And so the uranium atom has a time component that it's bringing in that is different than that of the hydrogen atom. All this can be expressed mathematically, and I'm not going to bore you with any of that, but the uranium atom's lifespan is obviously being different, bringing in a component of, if you will, a stronger attachment to time. That's how the people at CERN think of it. They think that there's this like ubiquitous force called time out there, like time is big giant Velcro in the universe, and each and every object has its hooks are more or less voluminous and able to hook onto the Velcro of time for a shorter or longer period. That's not how time works. There is no ubiquitous force like that relative to time. Time actually is an extremely fluid, changeable kind of a thing. Time is the opposite of gravity. It comes along with each and every one of the atoms as they create themselves from the Anu side through to the Materium side, and they bring the time of their lifespan, their existence, along with them when they come on in. Now, that also has overrides. We can get into that in template discussion. But the time associated with the individual atom is interesting because, unlike gravity, it's very, very weak close to itself. Time is very stupid relative to those other elements of time that are local to itself. However, it's very smart collectively. So all of the time components from all of the atoms work together, regardless of the fact that there's distance separating us in a huge way. So your farts matter more to the planet Sirius in a time sense than they do to the hairs on your ass, which are a lot closer. And the time component of ourselves moving around and acting is much more generative of a larger level of impact on the ever-present now, which is the way I collectivize all of the individual times that is brought in with all of the atoms. So our activities are much more impacting on that than we are ever on gravity, and we're probably more aware of our impacts on gravity or its impacts on us, you know, falling and tripping and so on, than we are ever aware of our own impacts on time. We can actually influence time. This is, I think, some of the information from the RV guys and so on. I do not buy the idea of multiple timelines, obviously, because the multiple timelines theory is part and parcel of the Big Bang Theory. It postulates basically an empty balloon filled with bazillions of different time streams that an individual atom collection like ourselves, our bodies, our planet, could flop from one time stream to another. And the Materium is not constructed that way. Each atom brings in its own time constraints with it when it creates itself and when it pops into existence through the Materium. It's already spinning. It's already got its lifespan determined. This actually goes to the old saying that the Swedes have around here. I'm in the Pacific Northwest of United States, and used to be a resource economy. I worked what's known as the green chain when you're going out and work in the woods harvesting timber for the lumber industry. At the time that I got into that industry, it was pretty much dominated by the aging Swedish immigrants to this region. And so a lot of the culture of the logging industry here is Swedish and Norwegian. One of the sayings that you frequently see, especially expressed because people die in the green chain very frequently, it's very dangerous work, is that the Swedes would always, you know, we would always hold a memorial service for everybody who died, of course. Interesting, and get into that in another time. Anyway, though, they would always say, you know, that Father Time wove the skein of your life before you were born. And that is their understanding, and that actually expressed what's going on, that when you're born, you're bringing in a collection of atoms, which you're going to, these atoms are smart, the time involved with your body is going to accumulate more atoms that have longer time and proceed through with your karma, but time is brought in with you when you are created, when you're born. Actually, before you're born, you know. So, as your atoms are coming into existence from the other side of the materium consciousness boundary. So, under these circumstances, the understanding that people have of multiple time streams is inaccurate. I can explain all of the multiple time stream effects from my little bloop theory in a much more elegant, in my opinion, manner than is postulated by the violence necessary for the Big Bang. And also think about it. If there were multiple time streams, think about the level of energy, the violence that would be required to shift anything, even an atom, from one time stream to another. Because time is a strong force, as the scientists will tell you. As they're out there, look what they had to do. They had to build CERN to try and smash time because it's so damn strong. Gravity was nothing. I mean, you know, Thomas Bearden and T. Townsend Brown, all these guys, they can overcome gravity without any problem. But, you know, look what they've got to do. Look what the mad scientists have to do to try and overcome time. They've got to build the largest single scientific horror weapon on the planet, CERN, run by the largest collection of mad scientists ever assembled. And they're running off in group mind on group think with a group understanding that's totally wrong, and they're going to group us all. And we'll know it when they fire that thing up and they hit the wrong particular frequency, and we'll be grouping food from that point on. Hopefully, of course, the global coastal event in universe will come along and smash the shit out of CERN, and we won't have to worry about it. Anyway, so here's the thing about time. The time in our bodies works with the collective time, the ever-present now. The gravity works only with a gravity that's local to us, and it really doesn't give a shit about the gravity in Sirius. It's, you know, it's basically lived in a holler all its life, and all it knows is its little territory, and it really doesn't care much about anything else. Time, on the other hand, is extremely cosmopolitan. It joins all of cosmology. And so your time component is something that really should be explored. The time component is also intimately involved with, at our level, the chakras. Because as the individual elements are created, as your body accepts energy, and it comes through the chakras, that's what causes the chakras to spin, is the energy being created and coming through into the materium. That's what gives your body motion and gives your heart the ability to pump blood, and the lungs to expand, the diaphragm to suck the lungs in and get air going in there. And the key to flow, all of this. And that is the spin that's generated as the atoms create themselves and pop in through existence through your chakras. The chakras are like a toolkit. There's interesting things you can do with them, but you got to be an adult to deal with that. It's not anything for kids. The chakras and the little bloops, the component of that, do actually, at the very center part of the chakra, where it does not spin, where the elements are coming through, that's where you can enter into the boundary layer that I call the stream, that other people also call the stream, lowercase s, I mean, we're not capitalizing it, but that's actually the boundary layer between consciousness and the materium. And if you want to think of it, it would be like we're inside a giant basketball where all the air molecules, and by going into our own little chakras as air molecules, we could pop into the skin of the basketball and do things. Go whizzing around the basketball very fast and go to other parts and do all of that kind of stuff. It's actually the chakras and the ability to get it to that center part is at its core the center component, pun intended, of the cities. And the cities, that's SIDDHI, are not people or any of that. They're powers that or abilities, capacities, truly capacity in the sense of potential, electrical potential and capacitance. But they're capacities that you get as a result of being able to meditate and get to these particular places that are as real as any other part of materium. In fact, more real, because they actually span the boundary between the materium, which is an illusion of our brains. And that is a long talk on only three little subjects. Boy. Okay, so this is going to be hard, guys, by the way, to keep my discourses on the immediacy data down to a half an hour. I'm going to try, because there's going to be four of them a month minimum, and it takes a lot of work to prepare the data. I was up from 4 this morning running the data sets to do the processing for the Thursday run. but it may be difficult to keep them under 45 minutes to an hour. Anyway, so this is a test of the Wujos. Hope it made some sense, and watch out for them mudras, nasty bastards in the hands of the nasties. Thanks much.